If you want to learn something new, would you rather learn it on your own, from a random teacher, or from folks who are the best of the best in that skill? I think I know which option most of you would choose. That's made possible by MasterClass. In recent months, they've added classes from the likes of Ava DuVernay, who gives us tips on how to reframe our thinking in all walks of life. One of our personal favorites recently was the one-on-one time we got with Amy Poehler in her class on preparing to be unprepared. So good. With Ava DuVernay. With over 180 world-class instructors and a 30-day money-back guarantee for new members, there's no reason not to get started today. And right now, our listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/hardthings. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/hardthings. masterclass.com/hardthings.
I chased desire. I made sure I got what's mine.
Welcome back to We Can Do Hard Things. We are over the moon and a bit scared and excited today because after dozens of episodes, today we have our first guest. We have decided we are only having guests who are an act of service for you, okay? And who are completely in line with our intentions that we can do hard things. And this is one of our greatest intentions here. Okay, after a decade of listening to people tell me the truth about their lives, mostly women, but especially lately, all genders, here's what I've noticed. Two interesting things. Number one, we all have a shitload of problems, okay? And number two, we all have pretty much the same 20 problems, okay? But we all think our problems are our fault, are personal to us, are due to some kind of shortcoming or fault or ignorance of ours. But if everyone is having the same struggles, how can our struggles be personal, right? It was like I was sitting in a meeting recently discussing girls and eating disorders. Because of my history with that and present with that. And someone looked around the circle at all the girls, one of the survivors, and she said, I just don't understand. How could this happen? What's wrong with us? And I said some version of this, but less eloquently. Nothing is wrong with you. You were just born into a world that told you from the moment you were born that your worth was in your beauty and that your beauty depended on your smallness. You were told in a million different ways that as a girl, you were not allowed to hunger or feast or grow and still be pleasing. You were just paying attention. You were just a good student. You are not broken. You are just responding quite logically to a broken world. And now you have this disease and it's not your fault, but it is your responsibility to heal because you deserve to have joy and freedom in this one wild and precious life you've been given in this particular beautiful fucked up world. You've got to live it in. And so our intention here is to convince you that there is nothing wrong with you, to counteract centuries of gaslighting, to prove once and for all that it's not you, it's them, that you're not crazy, you're a goddamn cheetah, and remove the shame, because most of our problems are not our fault, but they are our responsibility. So we got to work together to free ourselves. Okay. Enter our sex episode 2 months ago, called Silent Sex Queen. Okay. Your reaction was sort of ludicrous. The voicemails, the emails, the questions just flew in. And that was extremely exciting, except the only problem with that was that in spite of the power vested in me by me as Silent Sex Queen, I don't know shit about sex. Okay. So we needed a sex expert, a sexpert. Which I don't understand why they don't call themselves that, but that's fine. We needed a sexpert. But you know, I am wary of all experts. Until I sat down with this book called Come As You Are. All right. Now listen to this, people. Here's what I read just in the introduction. All right.
Oh, God.
So many women come to my blog or to my class or to my public talks convinced that they are sexually broken. They feel dysfunctional, abnormal, and on top of that, they feel anxious, frustrated, and hopeless about the lack of information and support they've received from medical professionals, therapists, partners, families, and friends. Here's what I need you to know right now. The information in this book will show you that whatever you're experiencing in your sexuality, whether it's challenges with arousal, desire, orgasm, pain, no sexual sensation, is the result of your sexual response mechanism functioning appropriately in an inappropriate world. You are normal. It's the world around you that's broken. I wrote this book to share the science stories and sex-positive insights that prove to us that despite our culture's vested interest in making us feel broken, dysfunctional, unlovely, and unlovable, we are in fact fully capable of confident, joyful sex.
Woo!
She had me. Well, she had me at come, but the title, Come As You Are, is pretty damn good too. Our first guest, sexpert, brilliant teacher, Emily Nagoski. Welcome to We Can Do Hard Things, Emily.
I am delighted to be here. To be an act of service for your listeners is it's exactly what I want to do.
Well, you've been untaming people around sex for a very long time. So before we get into some really cool, you're going to talk to us about the five things that really get in the way of us having joyful, confident sex lives, as you would say. But before we start, can you just tell me, whenever I'm going to think hard about something, I just need to know, first of all, what is the point of thinking hard? Like, why sex, Emily? Why is it important that we have confident, joyful sex lives? What is in it for us? Why sex, Emily?
On a certain level, it doesn't matter because it doesn't have to matter. No one's going to die if they don't have sex. And on another level, sex is part of being a mammal. You're not required to have it, but like it is built into the body that you were born into. Your body is the one and only thing you have with you on the day you're born that you still have with you on the day you die. And pleasure, Joni Blank from Good Vibrations said, pleasure is your birthright. Mm. And on a third level, because we do live in a world that teaches us that our moral obligation is to be pretty, happy, calm, generous, and attentive above all to the needs of others, regardless of the sacrifice from ourselves required, to revel in our own sexual pleasure is an act of rebellion against that message. So it doesn't have to matter if you don't want it to matter, but it can be an act of revolution.
Okay, I'm sold.
Yeah, that's it. Good podcast, everybody.
You know your audience, don't you, Emily?
No, that's what I say every time.
Rebellion. All right, I'm in. Okay.
Like, we no, just like agree perfectly about like
things.
Why have we been taught all this bullshit? How do we go about unlearning all the bullshit?
Unlearning. Okay, so let's go with that. Let's go with unlearning. What I loved about Come As You Are, so many things, but I loved how it was organized because the structure was helpful to me. Can you talk to us about your main ideas about the things that get in our way? Most of them are things we've learned or learned wrong, right? That are getting in our way of confident, joyful sex. So what are those things that we can knock out and have a chance at pleasure?
One of the main ideas is that people's bodies are different and some of those bodies are better or worse. And I'm talking now about, let's just go right to genital shape and size. We live in a world where people are exposed, sometimes at a young age, to images of bodies that have been manipulated, even images of genitals that have been manipulated. Some softcore porn will digitally make a vulva look like it's a little closed clamshell and they have no hair on them and there's no inner labia sticking out and they're all one color and that color is usually white. And we learn from seeing those images that that's what a normal vulva looks like. And if our vulva doesn't look like that, there's something wrong with us. And then the medical industry invents surgery to make our vulvas look tucked in, just like these photoshopped genitals. And what's actually true about genitals is every single package of genitals is made of the same parts. They're all just organized in different ways. And as long as they're not causing pain, They are healthy and beautiful precisely as they are. We can take that message that we are all made of the same parts. They're just organized in different ways, and they're all great to every aspect of our sexual functioning. Like that. So genitals is chapter one. Dual control model is chapter two. Everybody has the same mechanism in their brain of an accelerator, which notices all of the sex-related information in the environment. That's everything that you see, hear, smell, touch, taste, or crucially think, believe, or imagine that your brain codes as something related to sex, and it sends a turn-on signal many of us are familiar with. But at the same time, in parallel, you have brakes that are noticing all the good reasons not to be turned on right now. Everything that you see, hear, smell, touch, taste, or crucially think, believe, or imagine that your brain codes as a potential threat. And it sends a simultaneous turn off signal. So your level of arousal at any given moment is this balance of how much the ons are turned on and how much the offs are turned off. And our accelerators and brakes vary, for one thing, in how sensitive those mechanisms are. Some people have quite sensitive accelerators, and some people have very not sensitive accelerators. It takes a whole lot of stimulation to get their accelerator going. Some people have really sensitive brakes. So like the least thing, a stray fingernail, a stray noise, a stray thought can shut everything down. Some people have really not sensitive accelerators, or not sensitive brakes. So they're accelerator will continue working even in the face of a whole lot of good reasons not to. People vary tremendously, and they vary in what activates their brakes and accelerators. There are common ones among things, especially that hit the brakes. So stress, depression, anxiety, loneliness, repressed rage. We've all got it.
We've all got all of those, right, Emily? I just want to confirm.
Yeah.
All of
every
those.
Single one.
Okay, good. Just checking. Asking for a friend.
Yeah. There's also body image stuff. If thinking about your body activates critical thoughts about your body, that's hitting the brakes. Trauma history. If sex has been used against you as a weapon, as it has for so many people, then something that is sex-related and activates the accelerator will also simultaneously activate the brake. Mm-hmm. You weren't born with these connections made. It happened over the course of your life. You learned it, and you can unlearn it by thinking carefully about it, by doing worksheets and writing prompts and reducing your stress level overall, and therapy. Therapy is your friend mm-hmm. when it comes to untangling these knots, especially sex therapy. They're specially trained in these issues. So people vary. We're all made of the same parts, just organized in different ways. Because when a person is raised on the day they're born, everybody goes, it's a girl, based on the shape of their genitals. They start teaching them specific manuals, there's a user's manual or a script that says, here's what you're supposed to do. And nowhere in there is like, enjoy erotic pleasure for yourself.
I love online shopping. It's how I process my feelings. When you combine the convenience of online shopping with prices that allow you to save 50%, sometimes 80%, it's a slam dunk. And that's why I shop on Quince. No more going to a store and being faced with prices that make your jaw drop. Quince has an amazing selection of lush sweaters, silk tops, timeless jewelry, and everything is priced less than similar brands. Plus, it feels good knowing that whatever I order, I've actually ordered the white gold pave diamond hoop earrings that I'm wearing all the time, was made using safe, ethical practices thanks to Quince's partner process. So indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/hardthings for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/hardthings to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/hardthings. Tell us about responsive a desire, like that whole, because we got the dual control model, but I'm not sure everybody knows about, say it again, the desire response.
Spontaneous versus responsive desire.
Tell us about that.
So the super efficient way to talk about it is that spontaneous desire emerges in anticipation of pleasure, where responsive desire emerges in response to pleasure. So spontaneous desire is the sort of standard narrative that you're just walking down the street and you have a stray thought or you see a stray person, and that's enough for your brain to kaboom. Erica Moen, who is the cartoonist who illustrates Come As You Are, draws it as a lightning bolt to the genitals. Kaboom! Want it. And so you go to your partner, you're like, hey, partner, I have some kaboom. Do you want a kaboom? And that's spontaneous desire. And it's totally a normal, healthy way to experience desire. But then there is also responsive desire, which is more like, it can happen a variety of ways. One of them is you're like flipping through choices on Netflix you haven't picked yet. Your certain special someone sits next to you and like touches you and says nice things. And that stimulation goes up to your brain and it's some accelerator stimulation. And your brain, your body's like, so this is happening. What do you think? And your brain says, well, that's really nice. And then some more things start happening, and you might even like turn toward your partner and start kissing on them. And then your brain receives that input from your body, and your body asks, so this is happening now. What do you think of that? And your brain goes, you know what? How about kaboom? That's one of the ways it can happen. It's not spontaneous. It happens in response to an accumulation of pleasure. But very often, especially in long-term relationships, when we study couples who sustain a strong sexual connection over decades, how their responsive desire works is they set a time, Saturday at 3 o'clock, you, me, in the red underwear, let's do it. So you arrange the babysitting and you finish the last load of laundry and you go into the bedroom and you close the door, you put on the red underwear, you put your body in the bed, you let your skin touch your partner's skin, and your body goes, all right, I really like this. Mm-hmm. I really like this person. And that's how responsive desire works in the best circumstances. And it is also a normal, healthy way to experience desire. In fact, it is more typical of people who sustain a strong sexual connection than it is among people who don't.
That makes so much sense to me. Babe, that's what we've been talking about. We have to have dates because it's like once we're there and we've begun, we're always like, this is never a bad idea. Like,
it's
why?
It's kind of like exercise.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I think it's like unromantic to think of it that way. So we don't want to talk about it that way. But that's how it works for us. It's like we have to like make it happen. And then we remember why it's such a good idea. But we're not walking around all day thinking, this is a good idea, we should do it. It's like the other way around.
Exactly. It is not the people who can't wait to put their tongues in each other's mouths. I mean, if you do, great.
Yeah, good for you.
But that's not predictive of a strong sexual connection over the long term.
Very interesting. Okay, I need to ask you this one question because you said knowledge is an important, knowing what we don't know or what we've been taught wrong, like what you just told us about what every different labia looks like how we are all supposed to look like, unlearning all of that is important, having the knowledge. But you also talk about joy, that knowledge is the first step to have confidence, but you have to have joy, which is not only knowing what is true, but loving what is true. Can you say more about that, please? Because my favorite thing is this idea that everything that screws us up is this picture we have in our head of how it's supposed to be. Talk to us about that and sex.
When you talked about like everybody think about their definition of sex, not in terms of someone else, but in terms of like your own self, because the thing that gets the most in the way is this image you have of how it's supposed to be. I was literally like listening to the podcast. I was in the middle of like doing the dishes and I put everything down and I just went, yeah. Because that's the thing. That's the problem. We are all fine, except insofar as we compare ourselves to what we think we are supposed to be and judge ourselves against that comparison. And does judgment activate the accelerator?
No.
Or does self-criticism and judgment hit the brakes?
Yeah.
Like, The big irony is that one of the best ways to screw up your sex life is to compare your sex life and judge it as inferior to what it is supposed to be. So knowing that your body is already beautiful and spectacular and a glorious miracle is one thing. Knowing that responsive desire is not only normal, but like the kind of desire experience that is associated with a strong sex life that lasts for decades. Mm. Knowing that you have an accelerator and you have brakes. And when you are struggling, knowing that getting rid of the stuff that's hitting the brakes is more important than hitting more stuff that activates the accelerator. A lot of like the mainstream pop culture sex advice is lingerie and sex toys and lube and porn. And those things are great if you like them, go for it. But usually when people are struggling, it's not because there's not enough stimulation to the accelerator. It's because there's too much stimulation to the brakes. So knowing all of that, knowing what's true about your body, your sexuality, knowing what's true about your culture, knowing what's true about your relationship is where confidence comes from.
It's like, instead of giving me lingerie, sit down and figure out how half these damn meals are going to be made in the next week for the family so that the break of the ticker can slow down and I can make out with you. Because the lingerie is really for you. Also, not for me anyway. Just more presents for the partner, right?
Some people really love to put on lingerie for themselves.
Oh, they do?
People vary, yes. Every time you're like, do they really? It is so valuable because you're normalizing the people who feel the way you do, and you're normalizing the people who feel a different way. Some people, they're just putting on a show for their partner. For some people, they look at their bodies in the laundry and they're like, damn.
Oh, I could see that. That's so cool. I could totally see that.
I was like, damn, I wore lingerie for like the first 5 months of our relationship, right, babe? And then I just haven't put it on. I just see after the honeymoon was over, I just went back to sweatpants.
Sweetie, the honeymoon's not over.
Oh.
Emily just said the honeymoon is not over.
Okay. All right.
So knowing what's true is confidence, and it's knowing what's true, even if it's not what you wish were true, even if it's not what everybody taught you is supposed to be true, even if it's not what you want to be true. Mm-hmm. But then we get to joy, which is loving what's true about your body, loving your breaks, loving your genitals, loving everything about the size and shape and beauty and gloriousness of your body, loving your breaks, loving your responsive desire. Letting go of the idea that spontaneous is better, which a lot of us are carrying around this idea that desire is supposed to be spontaneous and just boom, kaboom, hit us out of the blue. Welcoming the idea that responsive desire is a beautiful, wonderful thing. Loving what's true, even when it's not what you were taught should be true, even when it's not what you wish were true, even if it's not what everybody told you should be true. What makes joy the hard part is that getting to a place where you love all these things you have been taught to hate, taught to believe are the enemy, means abandoning hope that you will ever be that thing that everybody always taught you are supposed to be.
Oh.
You gotta let go. You gotta grieve it. You have to have some rage about the fact that you were lied to for decades. And then you clear open the space for really exploring your actual sexuality that you have instead of the one you were always supposed to have.
Whoa.
Damn.
That made me cry. I mean, Emily, I spent a lifetime in women locker rooms looking at what I felt like was that ideal image of what a body should look like, you know, world champion at women athletes, right? And what you just said was just so, I felt like because I was bigger and different looking, I just felt like there was something wrong with me all of my life. And when I was listening to your book, by the way, if you're not a reader, listen to Emily's book, Come As You Are. Her voice is perfect. You're so good at reading. Like, I loved it. But I digress. And I just want to say, like, I came home and I had never internalized the idea that maybe I thought that I was wrong, like that my body was wrong and that my parts were not correct. And so saying all of this is like the beginning of like a healing for me. And I just want to say thank you so much. That's why I like started to cry just that now when you were saying like you have to abandon the hope of being that thing. Because so many of us struggle with the idea of not being the thing that the world approves of, right? And doing that and abandoning that hope is going to save your life. And I don't know, you just gave me permission to do that. So thank you.
You also gave her permission to come home from one of those walks and say, babe, let's look at our labia. And I just, Emily, it takes me a little longer to get on board with certain activities that books suggest. So we did postpone that activity.
She goes, not tonight, honey. Maybe tomorrow.
Maybe tomorrow. Right. We can hope for tomorrow.
Yeah. Emily, talk to us. Give yourself a long runway on the things that are a challenge.
Thank you, Emily.
And don't beat yourself up for needing extra time, because the best way to shut things down is to beat yourself up.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Agreed. IXL. Remember those three letters the next time your child asks you for help on homework. IXL Learning is an online learning community for kids that covers core subjects like math, science, and social studies in a helpful, feedback-driven way. So the fact that we cannot help our children with our homework now, which I actually cannot and stop being able to help them with after fourth grade, has been solved. IXL Learning's advanced algorithm is backed by research, and in studies done in nearly every state across the country, those who use IXL are consistently performing better in school. Plus, their subscription covers pre-K to 12th grade, and that wide range of ages and subjects is one of the many reasons why IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now, and We Can Do Hard Things listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/wecan. Visit IXL.com/wecan if you cannot help your child with their homework anymore. And there, get the most effective learning program out there at the best price. Talk to us about our conditioning, okay? Because one of the things that gets in our way, and you talk about so beautifully, is just the self-hatred, right? The disgust we're taught mm-hmm. to feel disgust about ourselves and about sex. And we get it from the media and we get it from our religions. And how do we get deconditioned so we can be free yeah. from all of these nasty messages about being a woman and sex?
I think one of the first things is recognizing that it's even there, because a lot of us started being taught these disgust responses to our own bodies and the idea of sexuality long before we understood that's even what was happening. I got an email from a woman who read Come As You Are. She was watching her adult brother change his baby daughter's diaper, which is great. But so she's all clean and he reaches for the new diaper. And when he turns back, she is touching her vulva. And he goes, ah, don't touch that. Mm. And like, you got to wonder, how would he have reacted if his baby had a penis instead? Mm-hmm. How would he have reacted if his baby had been touching her feet? Don't we love it when babies find their feet? Oh, did you find your pretty little toes? Did you find them? What kind of world would it be if when our babies find their vulvas and clitorises, we went, did you find your vulva? Did you find your clitoris? What a good girl.
So good.
It's a totally different world, but this little girl is not going to remember that moment. Or any of the countless moments like it. They're just going to accumulate to associate anything with her genitals to disgust, shut down, being bad, scolded. And in her brain, there'll be a dark place where her genitals are supposed to be. And she doesn't have access to it. And she doesn't know why she finds it disgusting. I don't tell a lot of personal stories, but I have permission for this one. When I was a kid, I did not grow up in a super sex negative family. I just grew up in a regular America sex negative family. And I guess I read the word vagina at the library because I was in the car driving home with my mom from the library. And I asked her, what's a vagina? And I do not remember what she said, but I do remember this huge flash of emotion that just like spontaneously emanated for this embarrassment, this panic, this shame, probably. So when I got home, I looked up vagina in the medical encyclopedia in our house, and the medical encyclopedia taught me what a vagina was. And my mom had all unknowingly taught me how to feel about a vagina. So 7 years later, when I began training as a sex educator, 18, first semester in college, my first homework assignment was to go look at my own genitals. I got the little hand mirror and I was going to look, and I had this flash of emotion and I felt like I was going to confront the enemy. I had never explicitly been taught, don't touch that. There weren't. And a lot of people do have explicit messages that that's disgusting and dangerous and bad, and no one's ever going to love you if you touch that. I didn't get that. I just got regular. So just regular sex negativity led me to feel like my body was an enemy and I was going to like march up and confront it. And so I lay down on my bed and I got my little hand mirror. It was a mirror, makeup compact. So there's like makeup on one side and the mirror on the other. Like, I'm a college student. And I look. It's the first time I've ever looked. And I burst into tears because it was just part of me. It was like the backs of my knees or the soles of my feet. Not something I see often, but like there and integral, literally just integrated into all of the rest of me. And I realized that I had been sending these judgmental messages to this part of my body. And that was not going to help it function more effectively. That was not going to help my genitals to be happy.
That's right.
So it was the reason I recommend it to all of my students is because I know for a fact that it can change people's relationship with their bodies. And that moment is actually the foundation for me. As much as I love the science, don't get me wrong, for me, everything goes back to that moment of when I don't know what's true, when I feel lost, when I wonder if I'm okay. My body already knows the answer. I don't have to look outward. I can just look in a mirror. I can look inside my own experience. Just as everyone, I hope you love the science. I worked really hard on it and I think it's very valuable. But ultimately, I and the science are not what knows what's true for you. You are who knows what's true for you. And if you get quiet enough and you look closely at what's actually happening inside your body and outside your body, you're the source of wisdom. I forget what the question was. Did that
hugely,
help?
It was a hell of an answer. It doesn't matter what the question was. That's hugely important and also utterly necessary, because sometimes what we know is true in our bodies is actually the opposite of what we have been taught by science. Okay.
So, and like, on top of that, the patriarchy has taught us to believe other people's opinions about our bodies more than we believe our bodies themselves.
Exactly. I've recently read an article about Freud and how he put out the idea that the vaginal orgasm is the only proper way to have an orgasm. And so a while back, it was decreed that if you could not have a vaginal orgasm, you were frigid. So that's where the word frigid came from. Frigidity was not being able to have a vaginal orgasm. Women were sent to therapy. Women were sent to doctor's offices. They had a surgery where they were moving people's clitorises closer to their vagina because they thought maybe that would help. So Emily, I mean, we have to go inside ourselves as a matter of survival, because the actual science and experts are telling us that are labeling us wrong.
Yes.
Say things about that and tell us how we can actually have an effing orgasm.
So here's the thing about science. I love it. It's great. It's the worst way of coming to know general facts about the world, except for all of the other ones. science is really, really important.
Oh my gosh.
The science is done by human beings. Now, I, as a sex educator and my colleague sex educators and other sex therapists, are required to go through something called a SAR, a sexual attitude reassessment, which is an intensive weekend or week-long training where we are exposed to everything that could possibly activate our cultural learning of, like, what's not okay and give you the squick disgust reaction. And my job as a professional is to make sure I let all of that go so that whatever person comes up to me and tells me their story, whatever they say, I'm fine. Like, I don't have, because they have spent enough time in the world having people respond to their story with, they don't need that from me. They need me to be like, all right, okay, do you? Mm-hmm. Sex researchers are not required to do that. So they bring to their work the same lies that all the rest of us were taught. It's getting better. It started getting better in the 70s and 80s when, guess what? More women became sex researchers. And they brought with them the assumption that being a woman is not a disease. We're not inherently broken. And it made sex research better. My vision for the future is that more trans and non-binary people, and especially more people of color, will become sex researchers, and it'll be made better because more voices are being integrated into the scientific process. But yeah, science has been wrong a lot across history. And, you know, it comes and goes. The full anatomy of the clitoris was in a mid-19th century anatomy textbook, and then it disappeared, and then it came back in another version, and then it disappeared again in 1957.
Why? I didn't know until like 7 minutes ago that the clitoris is not just like, it's like
not just
4 inches long, and like 3/4 of it is inside your body. It isn't just what's outside. It's actually the same length as the average non-erect penis. But we just, like, it's all the inside stuff. So when that whole, like, G-spot thing, that's the internal part of the clitoris.
One of the, so as you said in the last episode, only about 1/4 of women are reliably orgasmic from vaginal stimulation alone. And when I use words like man and woman, I'm using the language from the research, which is almost exclusively cisgender people. That is another layer of problem in the research. It's also a whole lot of college students. And something inherently built into the nature of sex research, it's only on people who are willing to participate in sex research. And that is not a representative sample of the population.
I would think not.
So there's all this stuff. So one of the hypotheses for why anybody would have an orgasm from vaginal penetration alone, the technical term for it is unassisted intercourse, which is one of those science terms that I just love, cracks me up. So one of the hypotheses for why anybody would have an orgasm from an area that doesn't seem to have a lot of nerve endings to it, which the vagina itself does not, is that penetration is actually stimulating those internal organs of the clitoris. I'm sure you can probably find like an image of this whole structure that you can put in the show notes or something. But it looks like a wishbone, basically, that straddles the urethra and the vaginal opening. And so some stimulation for some people with vaginas results in pressure against those legs of the clitoris. And that's why some people have orgasms from vaginal stimulation. Another hypothesis, the original G-spot hypothesis, is so wrapped around the urethra is something called the urethral sponge. It is the equivalent of the prostate. The prostate has two jobs. It swells up in response to stimulation and thus closes off the urethra so you cannot pee when you're very aroused. And it produces about half the volume of the ejaculate, the seminal fluid. So around a urethra right next to a vagina, when it swells up, it creates this like sensitive place that you can touch through the wall of the vagina. This is the classic come here motion, or some of them like a tappa tappa. Some of them love a rub, like pressure rub. Some people find it very pleasurable. if they're already turned on. Some people will only ever find it painful. For some people, it just makes them feel like they gotta pee. People vary tremendously. Nobody's right or wrong. People are just different.
But except for like, Freud. Freud why? Was wrong.
I mean, no, but no one's experience of sensation from vaginal stimulation. Freud was, I have a lot of things. I have a lot of feelings about Freud.
I have a theory. Do you, because it is unbelievable to me that we still, that most of us somehow, because of what's in the culture, still think that we're supposed to have vaginal orgasms.
Oh, everybody, yes. I get that question every week.
All the research shows us that most women can only have orgasm through the clitoris.
For decades. Yes.
Right. And even the way you say it, can only have orgasm through, it's like as if it's like this, like, Jave, like there's something wrong with us. Like, we can only have orgasm through this. No, this is the way women have orgasms.
Yeah.
That's the way I want it said. This is how most women enjoy and experience orgasm. Not only have it this
good
way.
Job,
not, this
sister.
Is a very good orgasm.
Okay. Do you think, though, this is my question for Emily. Do you think that perhaps the reason why the patriarchy does not want that information disseminated is that if the truth comes out that vaginal intercourse is not necessary for orgasm at all, that we need penises much less, that women actually can have orgasms from other women by themselves, that more and more penises are becoming completely irrelevant if this information is disseminated widely. It's just something I've considered briefly.
It's just her working hypothesis for the entire universe, Emily. That's all.
Yes, no?
Yes.
Yeah!
I think it's a little different. I think it is very convenient for people with penises who like putting their penises into vaginas. It is very convenient to have the narrative be, this is the ultimate source of pleasure for that person with a vagina. Mm-hmm. And to say, actually, no, that thing you love doing is just sort of an appetizer. It's just a fun extra bonus activity. To the person with the vagina.
And further convenient to classify it as, this is what should work and will work. And if it doesn't work to give you an orgasm, you have a problem.
You are
sexually non-functioning women. Right. Like, because I, over here, person with penis, am doing everything I'm supposed to do to make it work. But you over there, person who might or might not have a clitoris because I haven't noticed, are not doing what you should
are
be
supposed
doing.
To do.
Yeah, why aren't the men taking more damn responsibility? When I was traveling internationally for soccer, I didn't have time to come up with all sorts of travel itineraries when all I could think about were the matches we needed to focus on. But it was important to me that I saw the world while I was abroad. Viator can help with that in a big way. Everything from nature walks to guided history tours or adventure sports, all of it can be booked through Viator. Viator's a tool you can use to plan and book over 300,000 travel experiences around the world, no matter who you're with or where you're going. We've used Viator for family trips, and things like real reviews from fellow travelers really helped inform our decisions for which experiences to book. And because plans can easily change for a whole host of reasons, it was nice to know that free cancellation was available. So if you want to explore the globe or even your neighborhood in a new way, download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find the perfect travel experience for you. Do more with Viator.
I want to talk for a minute about trauma. How so many women's experience of sex is colored completely by trauma in their lives. Severe trauma, like over just being part of a patriarchy trauma, but abuse. How do women even begin to do what you, you know, to have confident, joyful sex lives when they've been traumatized?
Step one, therapy. Because mm-hmm. these are big, the roots of the patriarchy go deep. And to dig deep enough into your soul to uproot that stuff takes help. And because most of us are not trained in how to be with a survivor while they grieve and while they work through the rage of having this damage inflicted on them and seeing how deep the scars go, most of us are not trained in how to do that. So a therapist is a person who can be with a client while that happens. Mm-hmm. I often describe therapy as going into the woods with someone and standing quietly and calmly no matter what happens in the woods, because nothing that happens in there is dangerous. I, as an educator, am like, here's a toolkit. Here's how to use all the tools. Here's a map of what you're going to find in the forest. Go for it. You can do it. I don't go in with them. That is the thing that I can't do. Therapists, when trauma is involved, therapy. People can make lots of progress on their own too. And there are lots of different modalities for making progress. Come As You Are workbook has all these like worksheets that you think through what you were taught. And if sex was used as a weapon against you, what that means and how you can transform that narrative into a source of power. Mm-hmm. But the main, I would say, like, if there's one thing that all of us listening to this can do is to recognize that all of us need help. None of us are doing our sexuality wrong, and all of us need help embracing the sexual selves that we are. So when you say that you hate giving blowjobs, you are allowed to hate giving blowjobs. And if I love giving blowjobs, I'm allowed to love giving blowjobs, and we're both right, and we both belong, and we're both welcome. And I want that to be true for everyone, regardless of what has happened to them in the past. That when we hear other people's stories about sexuality, our response is never, ugh. It's always, okay, that's what happened. And if there's a skill people can develop, it's learning how to listen when people disclose stories of trauma.
Tell us how.
Here are the four steps. When someone discloses trauma to you, when you're talking to a survivor and they're experiencing distress, pain, there are four sentences. They are difficult, but these are the ones that work. Are you ready?
Yes.
One, I believe you. Two, thank you for trusting me enough to tell me. Three, I am sorry that happened to you. And four, I support you, whatever you choose to do.
And I also want to ask, what do people do who can't afford to get to therapy, who've been through trauma?
Yeah. This is when we're going to rely on our friends and family, making sure that they can be here. The safe people, there are probably only going to be a couple of people who are safe enough. Mm-hmm. And there is value. It is not inherently dangerous to feel those big, uncomfortable feelings alone. There can be an important psychological growth that happens when people are traumatized and they allow themselves to wrestle with those difficult feelings by themselves. Some people are taught that uncomfortable feelings are dangerous. Uncomfortable feelings are never dangerous. Feelings, as I say, literally every day of my life, are tunnels. You have to go all the way through the darkness to get to the light at the end. So you can be in your bed and allow yourself to grieve and mourn and rage, and it'll last 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and your body will have done all the grieving, raging, and mourning that it can do for the present. Mm-hmm. And learning to tolerate the sort of purging of those uncomfortable feelings is a very powerful skill.
It's just so interesting because it's like when we talk about this whole thing, I think sex is so, it's like the dragon at the center of our entire lives because it has this aspect of it that's like, yes, it's our bodies and yes, pleasure is our birthright and yes, we experience pleasure through it and loving what is. But it's like what you said about the very same activation of our brains that tells us that this is sexual and that this is the route to our own pleasure and our own birthright is the very same part of our brain that activates every bit of trauma and violence that has been against our bodies and against our birthright all at the same moment. Like that, and you begin to understand how survivors through the chronic degradation of our bodies and our pleasure and our worthiness over a lifetime, or whether it's a specific violent event, it's like how inextricable that all is for someone who is trying to get through their birthright through the same route that they experienced the attempted, you know,
removal of their birthright.
You know, it's almost like, God,
I used to feel so much anger during sex. I would say that anger was the emotion I felt most. Used, rageful, and then I would feel like a complete crazy person for feeling, I wasn't supposed to feel angry during sex, but I would just inner seethe the whole time. I felt like I could be anybody and I'm just being used and I'm just like a cat, he's a cat scratching a post. But I have to get through it because I have to. So, and I think that's all tied together. Like all of the world feelings about sex, I felt in the most personal moments.
And do you think it's because when I first read about like brakes and accelerators, and when you were talking about that, I'm like, yeah, yes, that is totally true. And also that assumes we're listening to our brakes. Like in how many worlds, in how many moments, in how many nights are you like, brakes say, hell no. Okay.
But your prefrontal cortex takes over and is like, no, you have to.
Yes. Right. And is that where anger comes from?
That is the classic recipe for pain with sex. Mm. Literal physical pain with sex.
So we don't even feel the right to honor our breaks. And that is how we feel in most realms, not just sex.
But like because your pleasure is not what matters. What you want is not what matters. Mm-hmm. It's what the men in your life need that matters. And so we are expected to sacrifice everything that we have, our time, attention, our bodies, our hopes and dreams, sometimes our lives. All sacrificed on the altar of someone else's comfort and convenience.
Mm-hmm. I have a question because I'm sure a lot of our listeners are in cisgender, heteronormative marriages. If you find yourself in a marriage, like I would say, Glennon, you were in terms of and being ragey and all of these breaks were there, but your prefrontal cortex, like what are some strategies that you would recommend to these women to help in that circumstance, to help free them of A, experiencing the pain and anger and trauma inside of these experiences, and then B, including their partners to change the outcomes.
Yeah.
How long do we have?
I mean, just give us a couple ideas.
Okay. One of the reasons it's so hard for people to talk about sex is because of a lack of basic vocabulary. Not even knowing that there are sexual truths outside of the ones that they were taught. Literally everything you were taught up to the age of approximately 18 was both factually incorrect and just morally wrong. And you need, you can't bust a myth until you have something to replace it with. Mm. Like, you'll just keep going back to the myth unless you have something like a wall to get in the way of you and that thing that is trying to hurt you. And the truth, the science, is my wall. It's what fills up the space where the myth used to be. And that's the dual control model. But some of it isn't science. Some of it is the radical moral claim that every human has a right to bodily self-sovereignty. So I'm working on this new book.
Oh, good. Ooh, how exciting.
And it's a... I have a chapter about the patriarchy. Because how could I not? Mm-hmm. And I talk about, like, I had a big reaction when you mentioned Freud, because, oh boy, Freud. Do you know about the thing where he said that in all my years of studying the feminine soul, the question I still cannot answer is, what does a woman want?
Yes. Ugh. Yes.
Right?
Yes. And also that we didn't need to pay attention to the big questions of life. That's my favorite, that we could only... We didn't even need to enter into those conversations. We just needed to settle into a lesser existence and basically do the damn dishes.
Women oppose change, receive passively, and add nothing of their own.
Yes. Yes, that's my fave.
He said that in 1925.
He's so homicidal about that.
What else was happening on this continent in particular right around 1925?
Voting.
Voting and labor rights.
Labor rights.
And you know what the marching... protest was in voting and labor rights in the early part of the 20th century? We want bread and roses too. Give us bread and roses too. This means not just that we want decent working conditions and fair pay. It means that we want liberty over our own lives. Beauty. We want pleasure. We want
beauty,
the delights of life. We want music and time. And here's the complicated thing about life's delights. They require time and peace of mind and a community that will hold our stuff for us so that we can step away for just a couple of minutes and stand in life's sunshine. Mm-hmm. To get access to the roses, we need support. Mm-hmm. To protect us from all the demands. We want bread and roses too. This women's sexuality, bread and roses, are self-sovereignty, bodily self-sovereignty, which really doesn't seem like it's too much to ask, right?
Nope.
And we want the roses. We want life's delights. Mm. And like every human on earth wants those things, right? Mm-hmm. It's just the expectations around women are different than they are for men. Like, if men want to have great sex with us, if anybody wants to have great sex with us, we would like to have great sex too. So the question is not and never has been, what do women want? It is, how can I help her get free? And how can I help her access life's delights?
Oh, God.
I feel like with the roses too part, it's just... this, like when you say you deserve pleasure, it's like what someone like me hears is like, you should want sex, right? Mm. But what I want to say is that, like, no, you deserve to have your life be set up in such a way that you are able to access your desire to have sex.
Yes.
Damn it.
Because it takes it from the duty, the like something's wrong with me that I'm A, not having pleasure in this, or that I B, don't, I feel resentful of this, or I don't have the bandwidth for it or whatever, and puts it in a place of like, no, you know what I do deserve? I deserve to have my life organized in such a way that I am not nonstop breaks, that the communal aspect of my family is set up so that I don't have to be 100% breaks, so that we have responsibilities shared, so that I can have access to the part of my life that can desire that pleasure and access that pleasure, as opposed to being the one that is in the position of feeling like I am a failure because I'm not meeting my duty to respond to your ability to access the part of your life that gets to desire and have pleasure.
Bam!
I'm looking at my sister and I know that in my head, I am already planning a sign for her wall that says, I want bread and roses too, because I know what that has meant to you, sister. Emily, I thank you for the work that you are doing for all of us out in the world. I know everyone that's listening right now is wishing that we had more time with you. So I want to tell you that we do. Woo! Emily's going to, the next episode is going to be Emily answering all of your questions. Okay. Emily is an actual sex queen. Okay. Not a silent one. So next episode.
I mean, my husband thinks so.
Oh, I love it.
We need to talk about the silence part.
Okay,
I'm not going to not talk about the silence part.
Okay, we'll start by episode by talking about the silent part. Emily, give us one quick thing that everyone can do this week to demand their roses. Is it looking at their labia? Is it ordering? Well, they're all going to order come as you are, but what other thing can people do that's easy and simple to claim their sexual joy?
Step number one for the roses is noticing the pleasure that exists now, mm-hmm. which will teach you, oh, I already have the ability to experience pleasure and enjoy it if I slow down enough to notice it. Mm-hmm. So it'll be food, it'll be friends, it'll be touch, it'll be your kids, whatever brings you the spark and makes you feel alive, that will be your light that guides you toward erotic ecstasy.
Okay, y'all. Next right thing, notice the spark. She is going to be back to answer all of your actually really fascinating, wonderful questions on Thursday. So come back for that. For now, if the next 2 days get extra stressful, don't worry, because we can do hard things. We'll see you back here soon. I give you Tish Melton and Brandi Carlile.
Other side. I chased desire. I made sure I got what's mine. And I continue to believe that I'm the one for me. And because I'm fine. 'Cause we're adventurers.
Can Do Hard Things is produced in partnership with Cadence 13 Studios. Be sure to rate, review, and follow the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts. Especially be sure to rate and review the podcast if you really liked it. If you didn't, don't worry about it. It's fine.
I am an outdoors person. I'm a big fan of places that are rich in culture, history, and art. And most importantly, I'm a former resident of the great state of Oregon, which is why I want to tell you about Travel Oregon. When you find a guide through Travel Oregon, you'll be able to leave the planning to the local guides and experts, and this is a game changer. Instead of trying to find a good hiking trail and hope for the best, you can get a tour guide to bring you to the must-see spots, ensure you're provided with all the necessary safety gear, and show you all the amazing little nuggets you might miss on your own. And because the guides and tour companies are small businesses, they're led by incredibly passionate people. You can find experts who speak multiple languages and know about a variety of cuisines. Or if you want a biking tour, you can find local guides to help you to customize your tour. There's so much to explore. Learn more at traveloregon.com.